I was brought up in the Jewish faith, and not really stringent, but we had some traditions and habits. And when I got to teenage years, I totally rejected it for a number of reasons. And I've really been quite anti-religion since then, which has sort of got worse during the years. But now, with this understanding, I look back at it a bit differently. Over, I think, probably Christmas or Easter, I was channel surfing, as you do, and came across one of the old biblical epics, which I used to love as a child. And it was the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. Sorry for the young ones who have no idea what I'm talking about. And I watched it. I really enjoyed it. And when it got to sort of the crucial moment when Moses has led everyone into the desert and they're all misbehaving a bit while he goes off to talk to God, and the burning bush is there, and God presents him with the Ten Commandments and tells him to go back to his people, to the people, and take these laws. And Moses asked him, well, who shall I say has told me to do this? And God says, I am that I am. So when I heard you say that this morning, I just thought, oh my goodness, it's always been there. Always yes. been there at the root. Exactly. And even when we say, you know, Shema Israel, that Lord our God, the Lord is one, how can it have been so misunderstood and so twisted over the years? And I know it's the root of all religions. And how has it gone so wrong? You know, how has it been so misunderstood and misappropriated that we have religion against religion when they all started with the same thing? I just sort of struggled to really get how it went so wrong. Yeah. Some minds seem so opaque to this. Why yes. is that?
Yes, because the evidence of sense perception is so persuasive. For centuries it persuaded us that the sun went round the earth. For centuries it persuaded us that the earth was flat. And now for centuries it has persuaded us that what we essentially are is limited to, contained within, and generated by the body. And as a result of that single belief, all these other misunderstandings have proliferated. One day, hopefully in the not too distant future, civilizations will look back on our era with disbelief, just as we look back on those that used to think the sun went round the earth or the earth was flat. Although we understand why they thought that, because it does appear to be that way. And hopefully they will understand why most of us think that we are temporary, finite, separate selves, because it does appear to be that way. So we can't blame, you know, all of us 10 minutes ago, whenever it was, all of us in the not too distant past also believed that we were temporary, finite, separate selves, because that's how we were brought up. And that was what our culture told us, and that's what the evidence of sense perception seemed to suggest. So that's the only explanation I have, but I share your dismay. It's a tragedy.
It's really quite outrageous when you think about it. It's
if you think about it, almost all the wars that have ever taken place on Earth have happened because either because the warring parties, either because my God is better than your God, or my teacher is better than your teacher.
And is there a reason why some minds seem so much more opaque to this than others? Some are more. Is it just conditioning? Is there more to it?
It's conditioning, but then two people, two twins, or two people born very close to one another, same parents, same upbringing, same conditioning, and so on, can one mind can be completely transparent and open, and another very opaque and closed. So in order to account for the differences, we then have to suggest past lives, which is a good theory. It would explain why minds come into this life, some so open and some so closed. But I don't know. I don't know. Why is it that all of us here, and all of you at home, we all have this deep, deep love of truth and interest in the nature of reality and nature of being, nature of ourselves. Why? Did any of us do anything special to deserve our love of truth, or did we just find ourselves like this? I mean, it's true, I was brought up with a mother, but not all my siblings had the same interest. So just the fact that I happen to have been brought up, I know others of you were brought up in the opposite kind of circumstance, and you had to find your way through life, and through the most unlikely connection, you eventually found your way. So the fact that you have parents who are steeped in this understanding, or the fact that you that doesn't account for it. What did we do to deserve our love of truth? We just found ourselves this way. We might not have done. So I don't know why we find ourselves. Some people find themselves with this deep interest in these matters, and others don't. I don't know.
I guess it's just a gift from God.
It is indeed a gift from God. In fact, speaking of parents and mothers, what you just said reminded me. Some of you know this story of something that Francis said to me on the first occasion I met him. He asked me how I came by my great love of truth, and I told him about my mother and how interested she had been, and so I was kind of brought up with this understanding, and she had really sparked this interest in me. And he thought for a while, and he said, "How beautiful, the mother handing her son back to God." So yes, it's a gift from God. Yeah.
I've been thinking about the idea of silence being the highest teaching. And then I'm just interested to hear if you have any thoughts on most of the creation myths begin with sound. And I also was part of the group that listened to Bettina tell us her story of her near-death experience, and there's a critical moment in the story where there was a sound. And I'm just really curious about the significance of sound as opposed to light or a smell or...
In the Christian creation myth, one of the Christian creation myths, it does start with silence. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word had not yet emanated from God's being. So the Word, before it has emanated, is silence. So the Word lay in potential in God's mind, but it is only when it was uttered that the universe took form. In Genesis, the same idea, that it started with the void. A Hindu creation myth that starts with the cosmic egg, which again is a symbol of the infinite. But if there's going to be some myth or some teaching or some story or some... It has to be articulated. So as soon as there is some articulation, you've got sound, you've got some form. Why sound? Why is sound? Why was it in the beginning? Was the Word? Why is the Logos the Word and not a sight? Or because sound is the finest frequency. Many would argue that music is the highest form of art. It's not the highest form, but the art form that has the most potential within it, that has the greatest healing capacity within it. Painting, cooking, dancing, writing, they all have tremendous healing power within them, but music, it's a finer frequency, and therefore can indicate the silence, which has no frequency, more accurately than any other form.
Could sound be an expression of silence?
It is an expression of silence, absolutely, yes. Yes, sound emerges from silence.
Because I think that my first thought was, well, is the sound a defilement of, or, you know, is creation this interruption?
Well, you could think of sound as a defilement of silence if you didn't understand that it was an emanation of silence and made on, and therefore made only of silence. In some expressions of the Vedantic tradition, the world is the body. It is considered gross, base, disgusting, something poisonous. In the Ashtavakra Gita, in some translations of the Ashtavakra Gita, early on in the first chapter, it says to turn away from the poisonous senses. So there's this very world negative, body negative, experience negative attitude. Why? Because it is rightly understood that pure knowing, pure consciousness, that which truly is inherently devoid of form. As we've discussed a lot this week, it is legitimate at a certain stage of understanding to turn away from form, to turn away from the content of experience. And that stage of understanding is enshrined in some traditions as a rejection of the world, a rejection of the body, a rejection of sensual experience. In this approach, it's just a stage, this temporary turning away from the content of experience in order to recognize your true nature. It's a stage. And then we go back to the world, which first seems to be not a defilement, but a distraction. And then we reinfuse it, like we did in this morning's meditation. We reinfuse it, or it's already infused. We see that it is already infused with being. Then it is no longer a defilement. On the contrary, it is something utterly sacred. So it would be a misunderstanding to consider them. The same with sound.
It also makes me think that, you know, rarely do artists become more elaborate in their old age. Usually things become more minimal or more abstract or more open. Like, it's almost like a return back to its origin or its beginning.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions,
yeah.
But...
Yeah, farmers become farmers again and potters become potters again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They just go back to... They go back to their garden or whatever it is, yeah. Jung did this towards the end of his life. He went back to his... he had a studio. He spent the last years of his life sculpting. I had my housemaster at school. He was a highly intelligent Oxford philosophy don. He spent the last years of his life in his vegetable garden.
Awesome.
Where I intend to spend mine.
I guess I gotta start gardening. Thank you.
The question is the dreamed world, a.k.a. the apparent universe, haphazard, or is it designed? In other words, do things happen for a reason? You just talked about Steve Jobs being guided by something outside of himself. What is that?
I think there is a telos. When, if I can use religious language, when the Logos emanated from God's infinite being and turned into the universe, that an impulse was set up, a tension was set up in the universe that is always tending to return to its reality, its source. At an individual level, we feel that as desire or interest, and that impulse for desire is, as we said a few days ago, it's a desire to be divested of one's limitations and returned to one's being. But I would suggest that in the world, in the universe, that there is this, because the universe is an emanation of infinite being, that there is this impulse in it to return to that.
So when people feel guided, or even the laws of physics or the direction of evolution, that's all the impulse?
Yes, I would say so. Yes. 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 To take what's happening in physics now, or your work, the desire to explore the universe, what's happening in AI, it's push, always pushing the boundaries of knowledge, always. What is the impulse behind that? I would suggest ultimately it's the impulse to go back to the to be resolved in its source.
So the impulse creates a vector in time, right? Basically of evolution.
Yes. The evolutionary impulse is ultimately to merge back into the one.
So that's the direction. The direction is the impulse. But didn't Infinite Consciousness make a decision to sacrifice and fragment?
No, Ron, because Infinite Consciousness could not have made a decision to manifest, because a decision is already something manifest. Consciousness doesn't choose to manifest, because a choice would already be something. There's no reason for manifestation, because a reason would already be something manifest. It is consciousness's nature to manifest.
Okay, so when people have extraordinary mystic experiences and they feel, you know, clear direction, sometimes vocally, that's the impulse.
Yes. Sometimes that impulse is felt just as an ordinary desire. But sometimes there are, as you say, a mystical experience, and your desire then is in a way it's more conscious. When a child desires an ice cream, they don't realize that what they really want is to be returned to their true nature. But the reason they desire the ice cream is because up until that moment, they're seeking, they're looking, they're in other words, they're trying to get away from their current experience, that they're in a state of becoming, in a state of seeing. When they taste the ice cream, the experience is so pleasant, it brings them back into the present. It puts an end to the experience of seeking, and they think they're tasting the ice cream. They're not. They're tasting their true nature. It's the ice cream just brings the activity of seeking and resisting to an end. The mind briefly collapses, and they taste their true nature. So even an ordinary desire is a desire to be divested of the limitations of the mind and to be returned to one source. But if when you have a mystical experience, then that desire becomes more conscious. You see the world from the moon, and you have this mystical experience about the unity of, and then you come back with a conscious purpose. You have a desire. You want to bring something to humanity. You don't just want an ice cream. You know what you want to do. You become much more conscious about what you want to do.
Thank you. I have a tremendous sweet tooth, and I finally understand why. So.
Alex, hello.
Yeah, so my question is about attachments. When I am practicing meditation, I can abide in being for 1 hour or 2 hours. But 2 hours is my maximum limit. I cannot go even further. There are several times I try to do nothing, just abide in being for the whole weekend, but cannot make it.
Like, you feel huge
emptiness. It feels like putting my life to an end, putting everything to an end. So this is
you
something.
You feel this huge emptiness,
yes.
Abiding as being.
Yeah,
when you're abiding as being, you feel a huge emptiness.
Yeah.
Alex.
So this is something I cannot...
I want to help you reformulate your experience. Why do you feel a huge emptiness when you abide as being? Why not a huge fullness?
Yeah,
why don't you feel the fullness of being?
Why for emptiness? The first 1 hour or 2 hours, I feel fulfillment. But if I go further, then the emptiness comes.
But now, are you not having the experience of being?
I have, yeah.
That's perfect, yeah. At any moment of experience, you can check. When you're walking down the corridor, when you're having dinner, when you're reading a book, when you're brushing your teeth, at any moment of experience, you just check with yourself, can I say of my experience now, I am? And the answer is always yes. In other words, you're always having the experience of being. You don't have to formally practice meditation in order to have the experience of being. Meditational prayer is just a formalization of the experience being. It's not a special time when you experience being. You're experiencing being all the time. The formal periods of meditation or prayer are just times when you say to yourself, okay, I'm now going to turn my attention away from the rest of my experience and abide exclusively in being. But when you stop doing that, when you go for breakfast or to work or whatever, you continue experiencing being, but no longer formally. You allow yourself to be aware of the rest of your experience at the same time. Like now, you are having the experience of being, but you're also having the experience of thoughts and feelings and sounds and so on. So, Alex, relax. Relax. Give yourself a break. Enjoy your life. In the Orthodox Church, when they speak of praying without ceasing, they don't mean repeating a prayer non-stop in your mind without ceasing, nor do they mean sitting formally in prayer or meditation all the time. They mean just remaining in being, remaining as being throughout your everyday life. That's what Brother Lawrence referred to as the practice of the presence of God. Just keep the fact of being alive in your experience.
So in your previous meditation, you mentioned three stages of recognitions. For those recognitions, does it require...
Alex, go slowly. Say that again.
So in your previous meditation, you mentioned three stages of recognition.
Yes.
So to get those recognitions, does this require more deep concentration?
No. Less concentration. Less concentration. You can only concentrate on an object. You cannot concentrate on your being. So if you're concentrating, you're doing the opposite of resting in being. Some preparatory forms of meditation require concentration. Instead of paying attention to 10,000 things, you pay attention to one thing. Your breath, a mantra, a flame, an image of a deity, and so on. That's valid because previously you were paying attention to 10,000 things and your mind was jumping from one thing to another. So the teaching says, okay, just pay attention to one thing, concentrate, focus on one thing. That's a preliminary or preparatory meditation, which we tend to dispense with here because I presume you've all done it in other practices and traditions here. What we consider to be prayer or meditation is a relaxation of concentration, a subsidence of attention, not a focusing of attention. It's a letting go, not a holding on. It's so that the first stage, be aware of being. The second stage, taste the nature of your being, its inherent peace. And the third stage, remain in touch with that in the midst of your everyday life. That's praying without ceasing.
And just by relaxing will also give you deep insight.
If you understand relaxing in the way that I've just explained it, the relaxing of attention, the sinking back of attention, going back to being, But as long as you're focusing, you're focusing, the focusing of attention, remember attention from a tendere, meaning to stretch towards. If you're focusing, you awareness are always stretching yourself towards something. If you're concentrating, you awareness are always directing your attention away from yourself towards that thing. Meditation, as we understand it here, is the opposite of that. It's the opposite of attention. In the way we understand here, awareness is not a stretching of itself towards an object. It is the relaxing of attention, coming back to itself. So it's the softening of concentration, the softening of attention, the relaxing of attention, the subsiding of attention. And you're it's beautiful, Alex. You're so earnest. You're so keen. You're so sincere that you're striving towards something. Being is always behind you. You cannot go towards it. So you have to have this. Replace your concentration with love of being. In love, there's no concentration, there's no direction. Just the love of being. You're not going towards it. So your sincerity and it's beautiful. You're trying so hard, but you're trying too hard. You're going towards something that is closer to you than you think it is. Stay home.